Hey there, everybody. This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome to the show. I am Michael Shaw, and this is episode 290, part two of two with Katarina Wong. If you haven't listened to part one, go back and listen to it, 289. It will get you caught up and make the segue that much easier. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see more images of Katarina, particularly in Cuba, renovating her apartment, which is something we talk a little bit about, among other things, and the memoir that she is writing about that experience. We also talk about FOMO and changing our perspective on FOMO once the pandemic winds down, and her artist collective, Plus One Plus One. Among other things. So short intro, short episode, but I did want to run a few things by you, including Pharaoh versus Allen and a very amusing caper that happened down in Houston, a botched burglary attempt in a Houston museum that I just read about. So wanted to share those with you in just a second. Thank you very much to all of you who are supporting the show on Patreon. And just really quickly, if you can afford to support the show, it would be very much appreciated. Just go to theconversationpod.com/support. There are a number of ways you can support us, including non-financially, by leaving a great review on Apple Podcasts or elsewhere if you listen elsewhere, and following us on social media. That is Instagram, at Artist Podcast, or you can follow me at Michael Shaw Art, and you spread the word about the show. For those who are not familiar, you've heard it all before. Big thank you also to Allison Widows, Van Cashinero, and Lydia Kegler for their help. Thank you very much to all of you. All right, so before I get to the amusing anecdote that happened down in Texas in the Bayou, just finished watching the Pharaoh versus Allen documentary. It's on HBO. Sorry if you don't have it, but maybe you can watch it at a friend's house, family's, a member's house. Really fascinating. And the reason I want to bring it up, because finally in the fourth of four episodes, they at one point talk about, or they address the issue of separating the artist from the art. So I thought that's why it was particularly relevant to what we talk about. Although we don't talk too much on the show about artists who are assholes or what have you. It comes up from time to time. And in any case, for the record, I am not going to watch any more Woody Allen films based on what I learned from this well-researched and filmed documentary. You know, he basically he molested his adopted daughter. That is basically what happened. It's pretty impossible to refute based on what you see. This is not a huge sacrifice for me not to watch any more Woody Allen movies. Certainly easy not to watch any more new ones, although those are, as you find out at the end of the documentary, they're getting harder and harder to make, and they're coming out only in, being made and coming out in Europe. But it's not even a sacrifice for me not to watch past films. I did honestly rewatch Annie Hall a couple years ago, I think. You know, I've never totally been in love, and if you're listening and you love Woody Allen's classic films, maybe this is a different, you think about this differently, but for me, it's not really a sacrifice that I will lose any sleep over. It's a pretty easy filmmaker to leave out of my filmmaking screening. It's beyond the question of separating the artist from the art. This is unconscionable, and it's a pretty easy call to boycott. In fact, one of the pundits, or one of the women who was in the documentary, the fourth episode of four, said she would no longer watch new Woody Allen films. But I thought, why not just go the whole hog and say you won't watch any past films either? She didn't say she was in love with his canon, but anyway. Enough about that. Let me know what you think. So here's the story from the Houston Museum. Actually, there was the Houston Museum. It wasn't anything any smaller than the Houston Museum. This is a piece from Glass Tire. I had the former editor of Glass Tire on the show a couple years ago. Houston Museum intruders escape by boat and drain system. On Tuesday evening, a pair of intruders broke into a branch museum of the Museum of Fine Arts Houston System, the Bayou Bend Collection and Gardens in the River Oaks neighborhood of Houston. The collection houses American decorative arts and paintings and sits on 14 acres along Buffalo Bayou. According to reports, a man and a woman entered the museum through a basement window grate around 6:45 p.m. on March 16. The alarm sounded, a security guard gave chase, and the intruders left through a door on the museum's south side. The police had been called and spotted the pair running through some woods towards the bayou, where the two hopped into a motorized fishing boat to make their escape. When the intruders spotted police on the Shepherd Drive Bridge, they turned the boat around and, ultimately, ditched the boat and disappeared into a storm drain. Police followed them but did not apprehend them. HPD also used a helicopter in the search and called out a dive team. The police recovered the boat and, according to Houston's ABC 13, quote, hope it will provide clues about the suspects, unquote. The only description they're given is that both suspects have arm tattoos. The Museum of Fine Arts Houston is performing physical inventory of the building, and as of this writing, it appears the suspects didn't take or damage anything. Again, that's from Glass Tire. I found that highly enjoyable read and story. If you're out there, attempted thieves, mazel tov on your escape. All right, let's get into this part two with Katarina Wong. Thank you very much for listening. Let us know what you think. I will update you about virtual cafes in the coming weeks. Hope you're doing well, that you're getting that vaccine shot scheduled, if at all possible. And be well and safe in the meantime. Talk to you in a couple weeks. So tell me about this collective that you are part of called, it's called Plus One Plus One. Is that how you refer to it?
Plus One. It's interesting. It was a group of, we're all women artists. We started, and it started, more than 10 years ago. It was simply a way of, one of my friends got a group of us together, and it was almost like a way of sharing our work, but also kind of accountability / socializing / resource sharing.
Right.
And it was, you know, when you're in your studio, it can often be a very solitary endeavor.
Yeah.
And having these conversations with people who have similar, mindsets was so refreshing. And we would just get together regularly where we would we would share did you hear about this grant that's coming up, or this gallery's has a call for entries, and those kinds of sharing that kind of stuff. And we would meet in each other's studios to share the latest, our work, get some feedback on it. And also just, be together, and it was just lovely. And we started thinking about, this is nice, and there must be a need for this in the larger community. How can we bring more people together and enlarge the discussion? And so we started doing things where we would have dinners, and everyone would bring someone as a plus one, and it. So we had it, but the stipulation was we shouldn't all know each other. So it should not be the same circle of friends. So they ended up being wonderful, huge meals with curators and writers and other artists, and having these wonderful conversations. So after we did a few of those, we realized we wanted to invite even more people into the conversation. So we started setting this up as a plus one, which is where our name came from, of I would invite someone and then they would invite someone else. So we definitely would have a couple degrees of separation, and we'd meet together in one of our studios. Everyone would bring a small piece of art, hanging it up on the walls, and that that would kind of be a conversation starter. Not that actually when you get a room of, you know, 30 artists together, or 15, 18 artists together, you really, it's interesting. You don't really need to have a conversation starter, but it was wonderful to hear people just talk very briefly about their work, where they were at, what they were thinking about. And the other thing that that was so unexpected was that there were many times where the work on the walls, even though we didn't plan it out and often didn't know, you know, everyone there, the work had such resonance between each other that we felt we were looking at curated shows. And so as a collective, we started thinking and pushing this idea of plus one, plus one, into the of letting serendipity, of letting these kinds of connections play out in a more curated or in galleries in those kinds of ways. So we did projects at Miami Art Week 1 year, and we've done them in galleries and nonprofits. And each time it's just so exciting. So the plus one collective has become something that's in some ways a real catalyst for more conversations and more connections. Again, something I think is really, really needed.
Yeah. How would you describe the, you know, the tone and maybe the kind of the objective other than connectivity? I mean, because that's, in a lot of ways, that's going on all the time, you know, especially in pre-pandemic New York, right? So how, you know, what is the perspective that you, your group and your, you know, vibe is bringing to the table that's different?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, connection is happening all the time, but sometimes it's not, right? It tends to be a little bit of an echo chamber.
Right.
Like we tend to be, you know, we talk to the same people. We go to gallery openings together, and we tend to see the same people. Or we might not talk to other people than the people we recognize at openings,
right,
and those kinds of things. So I think this was a way of actually forcing us to have a wider conversation, so that, you know, I've never been to one of our events where everyone knew everybody.
Right.
And let's see, there's like 15 people in the room. So it's not a giant group, but, so it's enough of a degree of separation where nobody knows everyone in the room, but it's a small enough group for people to have meaningful conversations.
Right.
And, you know, it's not a unique idea to us by any means, but I like that, you know, what started off as, you know, trying to build community and foster conversations and all this has turned into something where it's just been a way of opening up opportunities for other people that we weren't expecting. So like this aspect of serendipity,
right,
is really nice. And of course, all these things can happen anyway. Like I could go to an opening and I could start just purposely talking to people I don't know, but do I do that?
No, right, sure.
No, probably, you know, if I see a friend, I'm going to go talk to my friend.
Right. Yeah. It's a way of sort of trying to open up the serendipity a little bit more. You serendipity on its own,
exactly,
you know, has a very limited play. And so sometimes you have to work at it, right?
Right. Right. And then it's also a safe space because
right. It's
like, you know, you're not likely walking into a room of randos where you're like, I don't know how much, like,
You have that safe connection, that the plus one,
yeah,
whatever. Was there any kind of guidelines or you know, filters? It wasn't all just, was it all women or not necessarily?
No. Mm-hmm.
So no guidelines other than just a friend of a friend kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, all of us are artists.
Right.
We specifically did these gatherings to be, you know, artists showing their, you know, working artists, you know, in a kind of physical medium, but it didn't, it doesn't have to all be 2D work.
Sure. And what is it like? I like that idea that you described of being in a studio, somebody's studio, and they do sort of a brief kind of this, here's my piece, here's why I'm where I'm at, but it doesn't become a crit group, you know? So it's,
right,
as you said, it's like, it's a, you know, icebreaker. So that sounds really interesting. It's a way to sort of maybe have a friendlier, less confrontational way for fellow artists to get to know each other, because crits, I think, they can be really supportive, but you know, by their nature, there's a certain tension to them, right?
Right. And I think if I want if I want someone to have a critical discussion about my work with me, I don't want it to be 15 people. I'm going to invite one person in who I trust and who I have a relationship with. And I'm very specifically asking that person because they know my work or they know the kind of issues I'm working on.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's useful. This is not like a recreation of like some terrible graduate school moment or anything like that.
Right.
Why I think they've been successful, I think it's a kind of a conversation that is really needed. And, you know, like I said, like, we didn't come up with this idea. We certainly do not own it. I present it out to the world, to everyone who might be listening, to do this yourself because it's super easy.
Yeah.
And it's really wonderful as well, just to see what happens. And, you know, and it is not a long, you know, people are not standing up and talking about their work for half an hour. It's like literally like, you know, 3 minutes on each person.
Yeah.
And if that, and it's just enough to if you want to make, you know, like if you are interested in someone work, you have enough to go to them and say, tell me more. I was really interested in what you're saying because I'm working on this kind of thing. What's going on? You know?
Yeah.
And I think because of the nature of also my co-founders of this, this collective is like, we all have very similar approaches. Like we tend to be like, you know, I'm always saying like, you know, instead of thinking that there's a finite pie that we're all like scrambling over crumbs, let's just bake a bigger pie. And like, we all have that idea of like, go generous, go big, open up, like create that kind of ethos, contrary to what can also be a very competitive, can be very competitive, but if we, you know, we're kind of like saying, no, we're not going to play that. And so it tends to be that we tend to invite people who have that kind of, you know, ethos as well. So
that's great.
It's generative.
Generative, another buzzword.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. No, but I mean, in this case, I feel bad, you know, pointing that out because I really want to put the emphasis on the fact that I really appreciate that sentiment, you know, that you're bringing openness, you know, which to a world that often is, you know, that you didn't really say it, but it was, particularly strongly, but it was very implied how exclusive, you know, and I was at this art fair, you know, which I don't go to too many, but one of the great takeaways of being at this art fair is that this friend I was with ran into this woman who's an artist and was a museum curator at the time, who said, you know, there are two kinds of people in the art world. There are bridges, and there are fortresses.
Spot on.
yeah. So you guys are being bridges, and that's, you know, that's awesome. There are never too many bridges in the art world. There's always plenty of fortresses.
I was going to say we have way too many fortresses right now.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Yeah, and when you talked about the other members who are, you know, facing some things because of this circumstance that we're in, what about you? Are you, I mean, other than the fact that you managed to have access to a home in Santa Fe where you are, presumably healthier psychologically and physically placed to be than New York City. Are you coming up against anything other than that?
Well, thank you for asking. It's, I feel really, really lucky and fortunate comparatively speaking. You know, I am able to do my job remotely. I mean, there's definitely challenges, with managing an arts administration program where our students are in time zones across the world, and you know everyone's got Zoom fatigue, but those are really minor compared to, you know, I don't have children in school that I'm trying to like also homeschool and worry about them. So I feel very lucky, and you know. I'm incredibly fortunate to have had this opportunity to kind of check out of New York for a while. I was there for the first 6 months, and I did all this, the social distancing and was really careful about everything, but it's sad to be in a place that's known for its kind of bigness to see it really, like, my life reduced to, like, if I didn't have a dog, basically, I would probably never gone out of my apartment. And even with a dog, it was like a 2-block radius.
Right.
And so being able to be in nature, closer to nature, even if I'm not seeing people a lot here, and I mean, I have friends here also, but it for myself and for my psychological well-being, it has been just really a godsend to be able to be here. And it's also given me an opportunity to work on other creative projects. And I also think that I hate the circumstance. I was talking to a friend today about this. Like, I hate the circumstance for this lockdown. However, I also see it as an opportunity. I don't know if collectively as a society we'll have again for some of us to see this as an opportunity to be quiet and reconsider our priorities, or reconsider my priorities, what's important to me, and also to have an excuse not to have to do everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm realizing in hindsight, like I felt guilty a lot being in New York because I couldn't go to all the openings I wanted to go to where my friends were showing work, or I couldn't, you know, I just either I was too tired, or my job worked too late, or it was the transportation, you know, whatever. I just couldn't do it all, and I felt really guilty about it. And now I have a reason not to feel guilty.
Totally. Yeah.
And that's a little bit of a relief. But I also recognize that I am incredibly fortunate and incredibly privileged as well to be able to do this. And not everybody can. And
Yeah, I'm with you. One of the biggest advantages of the pandemic has been to not experience FOMO, you know, every time you don't go out to openings, or, you know, even one opening or whatever. It's interesting the way that I think about priorities around the art world and galleries and whatnot, you know, as far as what I'm not sure how common this is, but I've really decreased my art viewing diet quite a bit, you know, particularly for the first 6 months, but even more recently, you know, like, because there would be openings just about every week, you know, during the sort of on season. Mm-hmm. But now I find that I'm just like maybe going to see two or three shows or so a month, you know, in one stretch, basically. But it is nice to not miss an opening.
Has that changed how you feel about the quantity of art, like, in your life? Like, do you feel like you're missing out? Or do you feel like, I'm really paying more attention to what I'm seeing, or I'm being more deliberate, or are you just feeling like, I wish there was more opportunities to see work?
Yeah, no, I think it's the former. You know, I went with a friend on last Saturday to see two shows. Sort of, we essentially targeted two shows. We ended up going to a third that was a disappointment and could have been cut off. But, you know, just a few shows. And I think that's, if you can see one really good show, you know, when you do let's just say you do one afternoon and you can hit as many in theory as like 20, let's say 15 or 20 shows. If you see one really good one, I think that's fine. And I know that some people certainly miss going to museum shows, you know, for obvious reasons. But, you know, I'm somebody that have this sort of inherent kind of contradiction or paradox in which, on one hand, you know, I've devoted my life to this pursuit, you know, I've sacrificed a lot for this pursuit, and yet, you know, not having all this stuff going on or being able to take advantage of all this stuff, I it's not like I miss it that much at the same time.
Yeah, I'm having a very similar experience where, you know, that I have, you know, a couple friends here in Santa Fe that, you know, will go to a gallery And the galleries here are like, you have to make appointments, and you basically have these beautiful galleries and the artwork just to yourselves when you're there. And, but you can't do, like in, when I was in New York, you know, I spent an afternoon in Chelsea, I see 40 shows, right?
Sure.
And then you ask me what I saw, I'm like a blank, like, I don't know.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But now it's like, it's much more deliberative and deliberate. And my interactions with my friends are much more, I don't know, there's a lovely intimacy of looking at artwork that way that I really love. And I think I might have, this is breaking me of my FOMO. I think I'm going to give myself permission not to feel like I have to do everything.
Right.
You know, when we come out of this and just focus on the things I really, truly want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that I don't want to go to people's openings, but, you know, that there's other ways, to, more meaningful ways to connect with them and their work.
That brings back your study of Buddhism. And you know, does that help with, I mean, even if you're not necessarily, you know, physiologically inclined to, you know, to move in this direction, are you intellectually inclined to, or, you know, have a sense of how you can look at potential FOMO in a way that it doesn't feel like FOMO, you know, using a Buddhist perspective?
I think when I was in New York, I was much more, it's so easy for me to be on like the hamster wheel of like, okay, I've got my calendar is filled. I've got to do this, this, and this. And it becomes more about checking off boxes
right.
than actually experiencing things. And I think, again, one of the nicer things that's come out of this terrible situation is that because I have fewer boxes to check, you know, I'm actually able to pay attention to how I'm spending my time and just being more, you know, to use a Buddhist catchphrase, more mindful of that. And that's, for me, that's a good thing. That I can choose, right? I can choose to be as busy as I want. I can choose to have fewer things, but go more deeply. I can choose to sit on my couch and just watch Netflix all night and avoid everything else. But I'm, it's a choice. And I like the idea that I am present in making those choices rather than just kind of just having this avalanche of shoulds. I should do this, you know, taking over my life.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. That's shoulds are such, I mean, as New Agey and often maybe even not totally on the up and up as Louise Hay, has been, you know, her mantra on should was definitely a good one. Against should.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know that.
No, she just, yeah. I mean, she, you know, in addition to her literature, you know, okay. So in addition to her literature, she had some audio that she put out. And one of them was sort of this like almost meditative passage about should, that, you know, that, you know, there is no should, you shouldn't have to do anything, you know, or should is not, does not need to be part of our vocabulary, something to that effect, essentially.
Yeah.
I heard Ellen Burstyn on this podcast talk about having should-free days where if she wanted to have ice cream in the middle of the day and watch TV, you know, she would because it was a should-free day. She could do whatever she wanted. So she had one should-free day a week or something like that.
And the thing is every day should be a should-free day, right? Like every day it should be like I'm using it again. But even if it's difficult stuff that we have to go through, it should be a decision. Like, I know that this is, I know I don't want to homeschool my kid today,
right?
But I'm making this decision, not because I should or because someone tells me I have to, it's because I want to,
right?
You know, I want my child to succeed. I want, you know, I should go to the studio today. Well, I, you know, I go to the studio because I want to, or right. I don't go to the studio because I don't want to today.
Right.
I need to, finish writing the epilogue, of this book I'm working on, and it's really hard. And I do it not because I should. It's because this is part of bringing something into the world that's tough, and I want to do it. And I remember Tina Fey had something similar, like something about we shit all over ourselves. And it's kind of true. And and like that, usually that should voice, I think, is usually not our own. It's like it's my mom's voice. It's my boss's, it's some other voice that I've adopted to sound like myself.
Right.
But really isn't.
That's such a beautiful sentiment, though, and what you're getting at about, and I think this comes out of what you're talking about as far as Buddhism, which is to be conscious in our decision-making, which and what I took away most notably that I do, and I think a lot of people do on a regular basis, is we gravitate towards things because we feel like, because of momentum or entropy or whatever, rather than saying, yeah, this is what I'm going to do because this is what I want to do. Even if I don't like doing it, like maybe I don't feel like I will have fun at the studio today, but I want to nonetheless, as opposed to, oh, I should go to the studio because if I don't, I'm wasting my money paying for it or whatever.
Yep. Right, exactly. And I think at least for myself, when I get into, if I'm too much into like the should, I have to do this, I checking off the boxes, what I notice is I close myself off to serendipity.
Yeah.
Like I close myself off to like just the random person I meet that like says something that like, oh my God, I close myself off to these moments of surprise that can be really wonderful and inspiring because I'm so focused on getting my list checked off.
Right. Where do you feel like you are now otherwise, as far as maybe what we haven't talked about, how is it making work in a town where you're sort of riding out the pandemic? Do you have a studio to work in or?
Well, right now I've been focusing more on, actually, it's funny. I was like, it snowed the other day. We got a lot of snow. We got like a foot of beautiful powdery white snow. And I was like, I should go out and like, I should make a snowman out there.
Right.
I was thinking that would be so funny because that would be the first sculpture I've made in over a year. I did that.
Right.
But actually what I am working on here is the perfect thing to be working on in the middle of a lockdown and pandemic, which is I'm working on writing and a memoir about renovating an apartment in Cuba, and how that's also led me to reconnect with my Cuban heritage. So being able to just have a nice place to write.
Yeah,
in quiet and solitude, and it has been, it's perfect.
Do you mind if I ask you to give a sort of elevator pitch of, or really short summary of what your memoir about renovating this place is about?
Sure. So, as I mentioned in 2015, I very deliberately went back to Cuba because I was interested in this optimism that just kind of flooded in literally a month after President Obama made the announcement. And I wanted to connect with other artists and curators. And when I was there, I stayed with my cousin and his boyfriend who had bought and renovated an apartment. And I had really only recently had heard about that even happening because, buying apartments was just, it's a communist system. People don't own property. But things had changed. And I ended up just kind of looking at some places and I ended up buying an apartment. apartment while I was there. And I would say I bought it with my cousin because a Cuban resident has to be the one that legally owns it. And over the next couple of years, I embarked on renovating it. And in doing so, I was really able to reconnect with family members who, even though I'd been seeing them pretty much every other year, you know, I was living with them. I was staying them for weeks on end. I was, my construction Spanish got to be really good.
Right.
I started to understand from a firsthand perspective that, you know, if a hurricane hits one part of the island, you may not see fill in the blank on the other end in Havana, on the other end of the island. How I got to see firsthand how perilous, how fragile the economic system is there, and also how ingenious humans have to be every day of their lives to maneuver through this sometimes infuriating system. And so the book is really, it started off just like, oh, I thought this might be interesting to share. But then as I got into it, it's like, oh, this is, I was able to see how much I had worked through in trying to understand the Cuban side of myself, which I've always thought of myself as some sort of imposter. You know, not, my father's Chinese, so not quite Chinese enough, not quite Cuban enough.
Right.
If I'm around certain people, I'm not American enough, even though I was born here.
Right.
So I've kind of existed in this liminal ground between all these cultures and not being claimed by any of them. And wanting that desperately. And this was a way for me to kind of understand, again, like what I can claim for myself and what I really can't.
Is it, to what extent is the cliche around Cubans being, you know, among other Latins, people from Latin countries, but being very passionate, you know, and what, you know, maybe even, I don't know, I feel comfortable adding any other adjectives, but, you know, colorful and passionate, that kind of cliche. To what extent do you find that to be the case, and to what extent how do you feel you... your dynamic, how you relate to or don't relate to that?
Yeah, it's yes. I kind of, you know, I've had people say, "Oh, you know, Cubans are so fiery or whatever. This is spicy," and it's like, you know, like, "Oh, Cuban food must be so spicy." It's like, no, Cuban food is not spicy. You know, like you know, and their people are not therefore spicy, but.
Right.
You know, it's one of those things that, like when you're within the group, like, you know, I think it was my aunt who was texting me in WhatsApp, like at the beginning of the pandemic, they're like, oh, everybody's, you know, worried, like, are there enough masks? Are people, you know, social distancing? What is life there under the pandemic? She's, oh, everyone's wearing masks, but, you know, Cubans, we don't social distance so well, you know, like I can take that from her. But if someone said that to me, you know, I'd be like, what are you talking about?
Right.
So I recognize that I'm always like, I'm not quite. But I think that like with any culture that, you know, everybody's a little different, right?
Sure.
That, you know, yeah, so I'm not really comfortable, you know, saying, you know, yes, you know, I think sometimes you go, you know, like I go to, you know, part of Cuba, you know, I might be walking down the street and, you know, someone's being really loud, but that's not, I don't think of them as like, oh, like this is all of Cuba's.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't help think about it. And it came up as kind of a bit, you know, as a stereotyping type question, but because you described you're not fitting in, you know, to neither the Cuban culture, the Chinese culture, or even the American culture, or at least identity, maybe is probably a better way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, I grew up in Florida, but not in Miami, like on the West Coast, on the East Coast, mm-hmm. even though we have family in the East Coast. So, and in the town we lived in, it was a really WASPy town. And so there weren't many Cubans, and mm-hmm. there definitely were not a lot of Asian people. Mm-hmm. So the culture I grew up with, it was very, I think of it as very specifically, you know, this culture, my home culture, right? And which is this amalgam of Cuban and Chinese and American, and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
We didn't go to a Catholic church. I didn't have a quinceañera. My Spanish, I definitely can get by, but it's not perfect. I have very, very little Chinese, and what I learned in school, and so I couldn't speak to my father because he spoke a different dialect. So there are all these kind of misconnections. I don't look Chinese. So, you know, when I say I'm Chinese to an Asian person, they always squint at me like, really? Really? there's all these markers of belonging to groups that I don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And that I wanted, especially as I was coming into my own as a young
right.
adult.
Right. Well, as contemplative a moment as we've gotten to, I feel like we've covered a lot.
Oh, yeah. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. I think so, too.
But
yeah, thank you
I'm
so much for talking to me, Katarina. It was great.
Oh, my gosh. This was really, really wonderful. And, I'm so grateful for this opportunity as well. I'm excited.
Awesome.
To see what comes of it.
Yeah, me too. And we're out.